Call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 13th of April, 2015, and we've got a number of items to work through today, both public hearings and possible work sessions and some scheduled work sessions. I'll announce right from the get-go here that we will be carrying over Senate Bill 412 and Senate Bill 829. So we'll be carrying over Senate Bill 412 and Senate Bill 829. We are awaiting final amendments and paperwork on both of those. So,
812 and what was the other one?
Senate Bill 412 and Senate Bill 829 will be carried over to the next meeting. And with that, we're going to get started with Senate Bills 163 and 164. So I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 163 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 164. Senator Whitsitt, could you kick us off here?
Thank you.
Beth, you want to tell us real briefly what these bills pertain to?
Senator Edwards, committee member, Senate Bill 163 provides an exemption from the requirement that fuel must contain a certain percentage of biodiesel or other renewable diesel. For the sale of that fuel, it is exempt from an excise tax in counties east of the summit of the Cascade Mountains for a certain range. And Senate Bill 164 is similar with a different range, and it extends to all diesel fuel sold in that area.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt, representing District 28, which is Klamath, Crook, most of Lake Deschutes, and Jackson counties. Senate Bill 164 is a bill to try to alleviate a problem we have in the winter. This winter, it wasn't a problem. This winter, it never got down to zero. The winter before that in Bonanza, Oregon, temperature was 29, 34, and 33 degrees below zero on three consecutive nights. Biodiesel does not work in those temperatures. It tends to gel or congeal during cold weather. And gelled or congealed diesel fuels plugs fuel filters and causes diesel engines to underperform or simply to stop running. And when it gets that cold, it just stops. This property of biodiesel can often be prevented by the addition of anti-gelling substances, and that we, you know, for temperatures down to maybe 10 degrees, maybe sometimes as low as zero, you can actually keep the fuel working. However, when temperatures plunge to below zero Fahrenheit, the lipids in biodiesel blends tend to return to their original form, to beef tallow, chicken fat, corn oil, whatever. And it simply won't go through the filters. It plugs up everything. And the interesting part, when it gets that cold and it returns to its original form of lipid, then, Mr. Chair, those lipids can't go back into suspension without being reprocessed. So essentially, you have to clean out the system, clean out the fuels, purge the entire fuel system to get it out. Now, if you're on dairy and you've got 750 cows to milk and the power's off and your diesel generator won't run because of the fuel is congealed, and your skip loader won't run and your tractor to feed the cattle, everything won't run, it can be very, very frustrating and very costly, and the longer you wait, the worse it gets. In the 164 bill, this is for all biodiesel or all diesel fuels east of the Cascade Summit from November 1st until February 28th that can be sold without biodiesel in it. That bill would also address the problems we had with trucks and school buses. We had several different school districts that if the bus was in a barn, it started and ran nicely until you get about 20 miles out in the country and then it stopped. And in today's communication situation where you've got everybody's got cell phones and so forth, it's not perhaps all that dangerous, but it's certainly annoying, and it's if the engine won't run, neither will a heater, and so the kids are in a pretty interesting situation. So the difference in the two bills, the first section is both the same between October 1st and February 28th that allows the addition of substances to prevent biodiesel or other renewable fuel in the diesel fuel from gelling or congealing. This will help prevent the problems caused by biofuel blends and all diesel engines and temperatures to around 0 degrees. And then the 64 bill allows the sale of non-blended diesel fuel in any county east of the Cascade Summit from November 1st to February 28th. That really is the bill that we would prefer. The other bill allows for off-road diesel to be sold during that same period. That would restrict off-road diesel, or the diesel fuel that are not subject to highway fuel taxes. So they'd be in your tractors, in your skip loaders, in your construction, anything that's just used off the road, and in generators. And that's pretty much the size of it.
Okay. Questions, committee?
I have actually a question.
So Senate Bill 163 pertains to off-road diesel, mm-hmm. correct? Senate
yes.
Bill 164 is any diesel,
yes.
correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And why the difference in date? The off-road diesel bill being October 1st through February 28th, and the other one.
Mr. Chair, the difference is that there is a lot more diesel use on the road, and so I would have a more of a negative effect on the producers of biodiesel than just the off-road diesel would. And the other thing is that people who are using off-road diesel, like myself, tend to buy a larger quantity of it. And if you buy a tank full, and you know, a 300 gallon tank full of diesel or whatever in August, you still have it in December.
Right. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
You sneeze once all the time.
Okay. Other questions for Senator Whitsitt?
Nothing.
I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Okay, we have some other folks that are here to testify on 163 and 164. So we'll go first with Bill Cluding and Paul Romaine and Jenny Dressler. Next up will be Shelby Neitz and Angela Crowley-Cook.
Thank you. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau, and I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 164. In December 2013, extreme cold temperatures led to biodiesel gelling in fuel tanks throughout eastern Oregon, stalling school buses, farm equipment, and trucks. This was in spite of legislation in both 2010 and 2011 to allow for additives in the blend during four winter months. The additive was considered diesel number one or kerosene. Farm Bureau appreciates Senator Witz introducing both Senate Bill 163 and 164, bills that both address the different needs between rural and urban Oregon. Farm Bureau supports Senate Bill 164, which allows for a total exemption from the biodiesel mandate beginning on November 1st through the end of February every year for retail dealers, non-retail dealers, and wholesale dealers east of the Cascade Range. This will better allow school buses, emergency vehicles, farmers, and others in rural Oregon to better operate under extreme cold temperatures. Senate Bill 164 is not intended to skirt regulations or make Oregon's rural Eastside communities exempt from the renewable fuel standard. We believe that it's common sense policy meant to make a program that is already in place work better for rural Oregonians. Thank you. And I welcome any questions.
Thanks, Jenny.
Chair Edwards, committee for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. Chair, committee, I can't add a thing that Senator Whitsitt didn't cover. These are two good bills for rural Oregon. If you've ever been on the east side of the Cascades when they're having their cold spells, it's pretty obvious what goes on. So these are two good bills. I hope they pass. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine with the Romaine Group. I'm here representing the Oregon Fuels Association. We distribute all these different fuels, and we believe Senate Bill 164 is a very limited, practical way to handle a situation that can be actually potentially dangerous. The fuel in warmer weather is fine, works very well. We distribute it all. To have a the more general approach in 164 is much preferable to those of us who are those people who distribute the fuel. It just makes it easier for us. So we would appreciate the passage of 164. Be happy to answer any questions.
I do have a question about volume. So what, and I'm asking you, Paul, because I think you're, although you may not have the statistic right off the top of your head, I'm wondering how much, what percentage of the overall diesel sold in Oregon would be affected by this particular bill? It was sold east of the Cascades during those winter months.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm rarely at a loss for words, but I am truly at a loss for words. I have absolutely no idea. It's a very small percentage. It has to be, just given the nature of the population.
Yeah, okay. Other questions?
Yes, Mr. Romaine, why would you support 164 and not coordinating to support 163?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe 164 covers everything and 163 just covers certain people who purchase the fuel. 164 is broader and encompasses 163.
So you're saying 164 is a roofer's card in the union. It covers everything?
If you say so.
And Paul, you didn't say that you oppose 163. Your preference is 164. Did I hear that correct?
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chair, we would like a solution that covers everybody so we don't have to come back 2 years from now saying that such and such car got stuck out somewhere. It's easier for us if you just make the fuel available. It's a very limited market. It's a good fuel. It works very well in warmer weather. There's a problem. Let's address the problem. We don't need to go any broader. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I do have a question. Paul, I'm trying to get a sense of the magnitude of the problem. Do we have a sense of, you know, how often this causes a problem? And obviously it's not causing a problem now because things are warming and will probably be warm for a while, but they may be cold again. But just looking at sort of the record since these blends have been introduced,
Mr. Chair, Senator Dembrow, the problem with this, it's sort of like, in a way, alcohol bills. Most of the time, there's no problem. You really don't need to address it. The problem is if a kid gets hold of a vodka and drinks the whole thing, then you hear about it very quickly. All you need is one incident where somebody basically is on a school bus, something freezes up. There's an ambulance where it freezes up. It's preventive. Is it a widespread problem out there? No. Can it be a catastrophic problem for somebody that experiences it? Yes. Is there an easy way to deal with it? Yes. Seems like a pretty good idea to pass the legislation.
Questions? All right.
Thank you
each.
And I think I signed up for Bob Russell also, if on that sheet. I think he's on the same. Put us both on the same line to conserve paper.
You are both signed up, and I didn't see that. Bob?
Always willing to help.
Yeah, and I would have skipped right over him. I didn't. Sorry about that. Bob, please. You're both on the same, squished in there on the same line, and I just saw Paul's name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. Obviously, I'm here in support of Senate Bill 164. 163 would not cover my members, but 164 would. And as the previous witnesses said, when temperatures get extremely low in eastern Oregon, it's a problem. My members describe situations where they have above-ground storage tanks, and you measure how much fuel is left in the tank with a stick. You stick the stick down there, and out comes a glob of glycerin-looking stuff, which is the biodiesel, that clogs up the filters on the pump, the engines, and everything else in between. And in response to Senator Dembrow's question, it really is when the temperatures get below zero. And wherever that happens, certainly that's limited to east of the summit of the Cascades. And that's what the problem is. And it is whenever that temperature gets below zero. So I'm here in support of 164, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
just one quick one. Bob, do you know how is this addressed in Washington or California?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dembro, I don't believe either one of them have a requirement for biodiesel in their diesel. So it's addressed because they don't have it.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. That is all we have. No. Sorry. Shelby Neitz and Angela Crowley Cook. Shelby, not Shelley. Sorry.
It's all right, Mr. Chairman. My mother was young when she had me. But thank you and apologize for my writing. My name is Shelby Neal and serve as the Director of State Governmental Affairs for the National Biodiesel Board. We represent more than 90% of the U.S. biodiesel industry, 100% of the U.S. renewable diesel industry, and here today at the request of Sequential Pacific, which is a producer here in the state. I'd like to confine most of my comments to the technical aspect and leave others to address the policy issues. So, first off, we have a fuel quality hotline at the National Biodiesel Board. So if people have problems that they think are as a result of biodiesel, we encourage them to call that. We will fly out to wherever they live. It doesn't matter if they live in Alaska. We will fly there. We will test the fuel. We will do a full assessment of their fuel quality management program, tanks, et cetera, to define the problem. So I would encourage people to use that. Secondly, we keep in touch with the state's departments of weights and measures. We have an entire fuel quality program that does that. They are not aware of any, not even one single fuel quality complaint that has turned out to be related to biodiesel. So they receive those complaints, investigate those complaints, and they have not seen one in their memory that's related to biodiesel. As was pointed out, there was an uncustomarily cold winter year before last where temperatures dropped below negative 30F. There were some issues that was investigated and found not to be related to biodiesel, and the reason is this. So when you're talking about 5% biodiesel, which is of course what we're discussing today, the cold flow properties of that product relative petroleum are 100% petroleum, that is, are almost exactly the same. So while it's true that biodiesel in a B5 concentration will raise what they call the cloud point, it's between 0.3 and 0.4, you know, 0.3% and 0.4%. So it's immaterial. And we have a study on this that I'd be happy to provide the chair, members of the committee, or anyone else who would like it. So we do have hard third-party data on this. So this is addressed by users nationwide. Yellowstone National Park uses B20. City of New York uses B50 in the wintertime. Glacier National Park, Aspen, City of Denver, all of those are B20 users in the wintertime. And again, we can document all of that use. So again, that's B20 and not B5. With all due respect to farmers, and I come from a farm background, we do hear complaints from farmers quite frequently about biodiesel, and what it turns out to be often, and it was hinted at, is they will buy fuel, particularly row crop farmers, in the summertime, and then they'll leave that fuel over the winter period or try to maybe use it in the winter, and then they'll have some filter plugging issues. It is true that that happens, and they are completely sincere and correct, but the break there is that it's not a result of biodiesel. I mean, your petroleum formulations for summer are completely different than they are for winter. So I would encourage people to go out to diesel pumps. A lot of times in winter, like right now, and I have a picture on my iPhone for people who aren't afraid of germs, you'll see it on your pump that it'll say winterized to negative 20 degrees F. You'll see that on the pump. Well, you won't see that in the summer. The reason is because the refiners will use different crude slates, they use different refiner practices in the summer, so when you carry that fuel over, well, it's not meant for the winter. And so because biodiesel is new, they will assume that that's because of the biodiesel, when in fact it is not. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address that. Secondly, from a business standpoint, it may appear to be a minor issue. It probably affects 60, 70 million gallons, which is maybe 10% of the Oregon marketplace. But the problem for us is that our biodiesel industry, we can't operate like ice cream parlors where we sell, you know, product 8 or 9 months out of the year and then You know, we tell everybody to go home and, you know, come back in February or March. These are highly skilled biorefinery workers, and they have to work every month. And to work every month, they have to make product and sell product every month. So I think the impacts would perhaps be more severe than might be looked at on the surface. I think I'll conclude my testimony there out of respect for others' time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's go through both of the panel members and then go to Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Angela Crowley Cook, Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council opposes both SB 163 and 164 because, as you heard my colleague say, they're unnecessary. The biodiesel specs that we have, the fuel that we have, meets the requirements and is used in much colder climates every year at a higher percent. We're concerned because this would chip away at the recently passed Clean Fuels Program that we worked very hard to pass, and that sets us up for reducing climate pollution and encouraging locally grown and locally processed fuels here in Oregon. In addition, we'll reduce air pollution by using biodiesel blends instead of straight diesel. And I'll just conclude there. Thanks.
Senator Thompson.
Well, could you explain the beef? What is beef 50? You say normal is beef 5, and you say Yellowstone uses like beef 50, because I know I've been back there and it's been 50 below zero before. So what is beef 50?
Yes, Senator, my apologies. When I say beef 5 or beef 50, that refers to beef 5 would be 5% biodiesel blend, which is, of course, what we're discussing. So a beef 50 would be a 50%. Biodiesel blend. So when I mentioned that, I was mentioning the city of New York uses they use between 20% and 50% during the winter time and in certain applications.
Paul,
yeah.
So you mentioned some degree of temperature on a sticker says good to 22 below zero.
Yes, sir.
How do you do that? How do they blend that to get to where it won't gel up at above that?
Typically, when someone procures product, they will specify certain what they call a cloud point. And so that works from both the biodiesel end and the petroleum end. So if someone, say, is in eastern Oregon and it's October, you would go ahead and you would want to gear up for winter blending. You would specify whatever you felt was appropriate for that particular climate.
Yeah. So you have a bio blend that is good for 22 below, gel up?
So
I travel between here and Wyoming mostly in the fall, but I've done it in the wintertime before, and you'll get to the service station and it's zero or below, and all you hear the truckers, you got to buy number 2 diesel if you want to get over the mountain passes because they're afraid they're fuel lines and engines are going to plug up. So do you have a product that can guarantee you can get over the passes and survive in those temperatures?
Yes, we certainly do. So as I mentioned, we've done testing with the Cleveland Technical Institute to determine what the cold flow characteristics are, and we've done them with several different crude slates and refiner slates. And so what we found at the B5 level, that the difference is 3 to 4 tenths of a percent. So the differences between biodiesel and different crude slates are as small as 20 degrees. But again, remember, you're blending in 5%. So it's 95% petroleum and only 5% biodiesel. So the net on that is a less than half of a percent difference, which is, of course, immaterial.
So can you give me a number that you can guarantee on the record that it won't freeze at? Like what's your temperature below zero that product will not freeze at?
Well, again, sir, it depends on the petroleum. It's a blended product, so it depends on the petroleum. So in the summertime.
In the winter, it's not going to be below zero in the summer. Below zero in the winter, what can you guarantee your product to not stop an engine, because that's what happens? So do you know that number?
Yes, I do. My apologies for the lack of brevity. So petroleum ranges, as I mentioned, depending on the crude slate. So that can be as high as 10 degrees F and as low as negative 20 degree F, depending on the crude slate in the refinery, and that will be requested. So the biodiesel, when that's blended in, will not change that, as I mentioned. So that is a virtual guarantee. There is no difference. So as proof of that, Yellowstone National Park, and I'm sure you've been there, or Glacier National Park, or Aspen, or the X Games, they all use B20. And so they have no issues whatsoever. So it's all spec'd out and based upon what you request. So you can request a number one biodiesel or number two biodiesel, just like you can request a number one diesel fuel or number two diesel. It's the combination of those two products that is the relevant question. My apologies for an unclear answer.
So you can mix number two diesel with biodiesel step two?
Yes, sir.
Questions down here? That's all I have. Thank you. That is all we have signed up. So we're going to give the committee some time to chew on this one. We don't have paperwork back anyway, so we're going to carry over this. We're going to close the public hearing. We're going to carry the work session over. So closing the public hearing on Senate Bills 163 and closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 164, those work sessions will be carried over to the next meeting. And move on to the next issue. So, let's see. Is Senator Ferrioli?
She's not here yet. Do you want to do some more session?
Okay, we're going to, we're waiting Senator Ferrioli. And so we're going to get some work sessions done while we await him. So, ready with two. Mm-hmm. Ready with that one. Okay. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 246. Beth?
Mr. Chair and committee members, there's a no revenue impact in a fiscal statement issued on this measure that I just passed out, and it's been posted on OLIS. There is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Senate Bill 246, you'll remember, authorizes the EQC to adopt rules necessary for the development of for DEQ to administer an on-site septic loan program. There's a dash two amendment on OLIS as well, which establishes that the policy of the states to offer affordable loans to assist people to remain in their homes and promote long-term home ownership. It expands the on-site septic loan program to small businesses, limits participation in loan program to lenders that agreed to subordinate their liens to borrowers' consensual mortgage liens, appropriates a blank amount of money to the on-site septic system loan fund, and it authorizes the funds to be used for grants for performing evaluations. DEQ is here if you have any questions.
Okay. Actually, if the department could come up and talk us through the give your perspective on the amendment. I think, Senator Olson, I think you spent a little bit of time with Senator Roblin on this as well. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I have here with me Karen Tarno. She's a senior policy analyst at the department, and we'd be happy to explain the amendment. I'll let Karen start.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Karen Tarno with the Department of Environmental Quality. Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I think Beth did a great job hitting the high points on this. Just again, I'll give it my twist. There's a few different things that are trying to be accomplished with these amendments. One is really to get at the issue of foreclosure. The last thing we want to see happen with somebody who might obtain a loan through this program is for them to be foreclosed upon because they default on the loan. So both in the policy statement and the requirement that these loans need to be subordinate to the mortgage are intended to address those. There's also a line in here that leaves a blank for an appropriation for discussion at Ways and Means. There's one thing added to the opportunities to get money through this loan fund is grants for local entities to perform evaluations to identify septic systems that might be of high risk, so we can really target the program and the outreach to them. And then there are just a few things that were added to make sure that the loan program is authorized to address as many potential issues as might come up in a local area. That's why we added the ability to provide loans for small businesses in case that could be a real concern in a certain area. Also, to address the issue of sewage drill holes, which are in Central Oregon, an issue. They're trying to get people off sewage drill holes and hooked up to sewer systems. And those are, you know, basically covers the amendments. And be happy to answer any questions. Sorry. One last thing that we also added was just that the loans that are provided through this loan program are to be used to repair, to do repairs or replacement that meet but do not exceed state regulations. Just again, we wanted to make sure we can extend the program as far as possible and meet as many needs without having more bells and whistles that are needed on these replacement systems.
All right. Thank you both. Senator Olson.
First, I'd like to ask you, because we had met, and I'd like to ask you about how did we come up with the grant program? I don't remember discussing any grant programs.
Sure, Chair Edwards and Senator Olson. It was a discussion, a brief discussion, of part of the initial hearing, and this was part of the conversation that we had with a whole group of stakeholders prior to that hearing. What we found, again, we're learning a lot from how Washington is implementing the program. The grants, they're finding we need to have demand for people coming to a loan program before for the loan program to be successful. And people aren't necessarily are going to come, especially people who are lower income and having a harder time getting financing. They're not necessarily going to come to the program if it's not determined that they have a problem that needs fixing. And so in some areas, it might be a watershed council, it might be a local government that really wants to get address a problem they have. For example, maybe that they know that they've got problems in a lake. There's algal blooms that they think might be related to failing systems. And so one way they might approach that is to do some water quality, monitoring around the lake to try to identify areas where there's a higher concentrations of, for example, bacteria or nitrogen that might be contributing to the problem, and that might help them focus in on an area where there might be some systems that should be more closely looked at. So that's just one example of the kind of way you might want to use these funds. And the reason it's grants rather than loans is because there's no one really to pay that back. And it's an important part, they found in Washington, an important part of making this work both successful as a loan program and to address the water quality concerns that it exists for.
Follow up?
Yeah.
And I'm going to paraphrase. I can't write fast enough to quote you directly, but it says they do not want to I wrote that down. What does it say? They do not want to come if they don't have a problem that needs fixing. So in other words, if they don't have a problem that needs fixing and you give out grants for somebody to look for a problem that needs fixing, then they come to these people and say, you have a problem that they don't think they have. How do you resolve that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I'm not sure what I said, what you heard the first time, but it's to identify where there are problems so that problems can be fixed.
Well, you follow up. Yeah. You had said that people don't know about the loan program because, and low-income people particularly, because they don't believe that they have a problem, and so they don't mm-hmm. go on. And so if they don't have a problem, and you and I know when there's a problem, mm-hmm. And we have people out there investigating septic systems. How do they, one, do that to determine that there is a problem, and two, if those folks don't think they have a problem and they don't want to go get a loan, I can understand that because they don't think they have a problem.
Sure. Yes, Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, sometimes you know that you have a problem because you are very aware it's backing up in your house or
Absolutely.
Something. Sometimes the problem is really it's out of sight, out of mind, because it's a problem where the system is failing, but it's the outcome of that is water pollution or groundwater pollution. And so your experience might be that the system, everything's still flushing through, but the water body that where the drain field is or lack of a drain field might be discharging to could be causing a water quality problem downstream.
follow up?
Yeah.
So you're saying that a system that might be 200, 300 yards from a water body is going to send pollutant where the system works and it goes out there and the water goes out and it's supposed to go straight down into the soil. You're saying that that system is now not going straight down the soil, it's sending the water out to the stream. And how would someone come in and determine that?
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, in that situation, I don't know that that situation would exist, but in situations where properties were more adjacent to the McKenzie River or 10 Mile Lake or something like that is one of the ideas where these kinds of surveys, and in fact, talking with EWEB on McKenzie River, they've done some studies where they look at actually geographic information systems, like mapping data of soil type, of age of the house, of proximity to water bodies. Again, to just help get a sense of where these problems, where if a system was failing, it would be more, it could result in a water quality problem, so that then the professionals can go around and do a closer look at those systems to see if they've got all the parts they need, if, you know, to ensure the drain field is functioning properly, that sort of thing.
Follow up?
Yeah.
How much money then will come from, I remember the original request was $4 million. How much are we talking about that's going to come out and never get paid back? What kind of grants are you going to give out?
Sure, Senator Olson, or Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. I think that's a detail that would be worked out during the rulemaking in the program. Again, it's something at the beginning of the program. It might be more helpful. We've had some requests from particularly the Coos Bay area, one of the county commissioners there, saying this is what we really need right now is we need some help to better hone in on where the problem systems are. So beginning of the program might be more favorable to put out some $20,000, $30,000 grants perhaps to help do some local investigations. Later on, it might not be so necessary.
And one last.
Yeah.
The one thing that I noticed that wasn't in here was the protection for the homeowner if they have to switch over to a $25,000 or $30,000 system that they can't afford to pay for. How do we resolve that?
Mm-hmm. Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, the loan programs are, as designed in Washington, are often have tiers based upon people's ability to pay, including in some programs they design an option where it's there is no payment until the home sells. So they really do try to structure them to try to meet everybody's needs, and you know I. In the situation, if there is no possible way to fund the repair or the replacement, you know, I imagine there's some of those scenarios out there. But I know the loan programs that have been working in Washington have been able, as I understand, to serve a lot of people in pretty dire straits.
Do they use the sand filter systems?
I'm not certain of the answer to that. I do know that in Washington they have a lot of systems. They're particularly worried about the Puget Sound area, and in a lot of those areas they do have higher cost systems. I'm not sure if they're sand systems or advanced treatment, but they do expect that those systems in that area close to the sound, because of the geology, are more in the $25,000 to $35,000
realm. And if I can add,
please.
Chair and Senator Olson, this was also why we put language in the amendment to make it clear that a loan coming from this program is limited to paying for what the state sets as the standard for an on-site system, and no more, no less than that. And that was our attempt to ensure that the loans would just pay for what, you know, DEQ requires, as opposed to anything else. Now, the local governments would be free in a loan program with a different source of funding to make loans for requirements that go beyond the state requirements. But for the state money that comes through this program, it would be limited to meeting DEQ requirements.
So then for the record, your standards could be lower than county standards.
It is possible. We are not really aware of any. We talked to staff and we're not aware of that, but at least it's possible, yes.
And just the one thing that we were able to drum up is that there's some counties or local governments that have proposed a certain kind of interval for getting your system inspected.
Mm-hmm.
but our staff couldn't come up with any local governments where they've got to actually higher treatment requirement, higher system requirement. We weren't familiar with anyone.
I will state that this amendment comes far short of what I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. So, did I see your hand up down there? Okay.
No. I just have a comment.
So I have a question. And Senator Olson got me to thinking about this. So, with his line of questioning, so is it possible or foreseeable that a grant you could give out some grant money, say to a local county, they do some education, some inspection, that local jurisdiction says, "Hey, homeowner next to the lake, looks like you have a failing system," and then, so the state, the terms of this state revolving loan program will fund up to X, but because of where you're located and, you know, and the type of ground and everything, that's not going to cut it for you guys. And really what the local county needs is different. And now they're in a position of liability, and they've kind of been ensnared by a program, and I don't think that's what we want to do with this program. We don't want to ensnare people. We want to give them a tool mm-hmm. to make the necessary upgrades that they need to make, both for water quality purposes and for, you know, health and safety and everything. So I don't know if that's what Senator Olson was driving toward, but I mean, I think that's a legitimate concern. So how would the bill and the amendments assure that that is not what's going to happen?
Well, I'll start and then Karen, you know, jump in. So Senator Edwards, first of all, and probably just so it's clear on the record, these loans are voluntary, but I understand the concern we're talking about, and this would include myself if I was dealing with a septic tank issue. I'm by no means an expert, and I'm relying on the service provider to tell me what I need to do with my system. But the loans are voluntary. They are based on the ability of the loanee to make the payments. What we put in the bill was language to say that if you take a loan from this program, all that loan can do is replace a damaged or an operable system or make an upgrade to an existing system that meets the state standards. There may be instances where local governments do, as Karen said, have more advanced or more stringent treatment requirements. We're not really aware that that's the case, but that is possible, or it may be possible in the future. But this program could not be the source of money for that level of improvement. There would have to be some other source of money to make that level of improvement. I think that's getting at the question you're asking.
And maybe just one thing, Chair Edwards, is that for any of these projects to go forward, they need to be permitted by the authority, which might be the county or DEQ, depending on what county you're in. And so that on-site authority would be making a determination as to whether the what was recommended, for example, by the service provider is what's appropriate for that area. So I'm not sure if that helps at all, Senator Olson.
No.
Sorry.
No, I think the question that I have, and I hear what you said, Palmer, but what I'm concerned at, and I'm not sure that you spoke to, is the scenario in which the grant funds are used to kind of do a local kind of an education mm-hmm. sweep, kind of cleanup of the failing septic systems in a certain fragile area or important area or whatever, and in doing so, that uncovers a bunch of failing systems. There's now a mandate to correct those systems, and then the loan program, in fact, doesn't cover it.
Right.
That's what I'm worried about.
And I see, Chair Edwards, I see your question. I think there's perhaps some risk of that, but at the same time, it's important to do these evaluations because we're going to have, through this state program, a limited amount of money, I think, and a need that exceeds the amount of money that's available to do the work. So to sort of get the best return on the state money that we have, it would probably be prudent in many cases to do an evaluation to figure out where the failing or inoperable systems are and try to target that money. Does that mean in doing so that we uncover a system that person chooses not to take the loan, or there isn't enough money through the local loan program to address all the systems and they have a now known liability that may or may not have been known before? I think there's maybe some risk of that, but we're looking at this as a way to help folks who, even now, if they knew about a problem with their septic tank, it was uncovered some other way, wouldn't have the means to fix it. And sure, there's always the ability of DEQ to go and try to do an enforcement action or something like that, but we're sensitive to the fact that if you don't have the ability to fix the problem, we're not sure what an enforcement action will do in those cases. It's why we need this loan program, is to get at a problem that's not solvable through enforcement. It's solvable through additional resources. But I hear your concern. That could happen where we uncover problems that people didn't know about existing. But I don't know how else to try to address this problem except for additional resources.
Well, and I guess it is in my concern comes that in trying to make the loan program whole and trying to stretch scarce resources as far as possible, that while you would presumably target the loans, any individual loan may not be sufficient, and the deficit is being picked up by the homeowner. And that all came about because of this program, which I think I'm totally supportive of where we're trying to go with this. I'm just trying to make sure that ordinary folks don't kind of get ensnared by this program that's set up to help them.
And I agree with the chair. I'm totally supportive of this program. But my large concern was that we come upon someone that needs a repair that has to go to a higher level and they can't afford it. And if they can't afford to pay for it, then the one thing we didn't address in the amendment was, what do we do? Do we kick them out of their house, or do we let that system continue to fail? And by doing the grant program, you kind of let the sheriff out without the jury behind him saying, you can go and investigate here, and you're sweeping up people now and putting them into a precarious position, not knowing whether their system is failing or not, which they're pretty easy when they do fail. You know that. You flush the toilet, it comes back at you. It doesn't go the other way, it comes at you. Your system's in trouble. But the problem is that we're taking precious funds and we're giving it to a grant that allows people to go out and investigate to see if these people are failing or not, and then we find out they are, then they have to pay more money than they can afford to pay, so we put them in a precarious position, and they could possibly lose their home because of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the caution that we have to look at.
Sure.
And we didn't address that. As a matter of fact, when we expanded with the grant, we expanded the opportunity to catch them.
Sure. Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, I think I see your point more clearly now, and certainly would be happy to go back and think about this some more. Also, I think part of particularly what Senator Edwards is raising is, you know, does the system cost more than they can get the loan for? I have not understood that to be a concern in Washington. The way the loan program works is you get basically a bid on your – well, actually, you identify that you need to have your system looked at. You go to the loan program and you apply to qualify for a loan. Once you open that and get qualified, then you go back and you have somebody come in and do a bid so that they can be paid by the loan. You have them get the permit so those can be paid out of the loan, and then it covers the system. So they, you know, it's not like you're pre-approved for $15,000 and no more. You're approved. You're considered for approved for a loan, and then the dollar amount is kind of penciled out once they've got that.
But the
bid.
Step you missed, mm-hmm. you've got the loan money, you've got the contractor giving a bid, but the step you leave out is the county telling you what kind of system you can have, because they're the ultimate permitter of it. And so you'd have to come in and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Now, this is the bid. This is what it's going to cost to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's $30,000, that's a lot of money compared to $5,000. And that's where you're not covering what Washington does in those instances, and that's what we really need to know, because I don't want folks losing their house over this.
Sure.
So let's take this up offline. We're going to carry this work session over. I don't want to lose this program.
Neither do I.
I think Senator Olson actually wants this to happen. We just want to make sure that the language is right. Maybe it is right now. We just need a better understanding of it, but I'm not convinced yet. So I'd like to take it up with Senator Roblin as well, who's been working on it.
Excellent.
Take it up with you guys. So we are going to carry over the work session on Senate Bill 246 to our next meeting. And now we are going to move on to, we have Senator Farioli here. He is here for Senate Bill 748. So we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 748. Beth, do you want to brief us while Senator Farioli comes forth?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 748 would authorize a county that has experienced a sustained high unemployment, population decline, or poverty level to adopt certain poverty level to adopt an exception to a statewide land use goal for unemployment use that will create 10 or more new full-time jobs with a wage of 400% or more of the federal poverty level for a family of four.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ted Farioli, District 30, here in support of Senate Bill 748. And as Administrator Beth Riley explained very super adequately, I'm sure, this is a bill that would allow local governments to adopt exceptions to the statewide land use planning system under very specific circumstances. And if you look at Senate Bill 748 in text, those circumstances are enumerated. High poverty, and high poverty is 25% of the residents of the local government have taxable income as defined by our statutes that is below the federal poverty level. 50% of the residents of the local government have taxable income defined as below 75% of the median taxable income, or if the community has sustained high unemployment. Sustained high unemployment would be a monthly average unemployment rate determined by the employment department of the local government is higher than 7% for the last for at least 24 consecutive months. And then also the community would have to be suffering sustained population decline, and that would be based on the federal decadal census, and they would have to show that over a 10-year period from the immediate past decadal census. And then they would have to also demonstrate population loss in each of the five preceding calendar years as determined by the Census Bureau or the Portland State University Population Research Center. This is a picture of despair. These are communities that really are impoverished. They're losing population. There's a serious high unemployment problem. They are communities that are recipients of a lot of transfer of value from urban areas to suburban and rural areas because they're simply not able to earn their own way forward. If I look at these communities, I can also characterize their local governmental organizations as being underfunded and sometimes not capable of dealing with the issues that would be required to deal with to get an exception without this passage of 748, or just to go through the land use procedures for something like an urban growth boundary expansion or any other exception to land use rules. It's an arduous, difficult, time-consuming, expensive process, and local jurisdictions simply don't have the resources to pursue these things. Senate Bill 748 is modeled on a law that currently exists in Washington State that's functioning fairly well, and it's based on the same sort of indicators. Loss of population, high unemployment, long-term economic dislocations, and those communities are free to do whatever it is that they can do to try to stimulate some kind of economic growth in our community and return some stability. So, you know, let me give you an example, and then let me anticipate some folks that may oppose this bill. Grant County is an example. I just use that as the county as an example because it's the county where I live. The population when I moved there was over 8,400 people. Today the population is around 7,000 people. I've lived there for approximately 20 years. So the county is 8,000 square miles, and it has 7,000 people. So you can do the math in terms of the population density. Open space isn't a problem. Most of the land there is either it's zoned resource land, and it can either be grazing or farmland. But let me tell you that farmland in the Willamette Valley looks different than farmland in Grant County, where we get 9 to 10 inches or 9 to 12 inches of rain every year. You may hear from people that these are fragile ecosystems, but they're also communities that are fragile economically. So the purpose of Senate Bill 748 is to empower the local community if it can demonstrate specific economic and social concerns, and it can verify those issues, to allow some exceptions to the statewide land use planning goals so that they could actually attract businesses. I think we all worked very hard on Senate Bill 611. And others that would allow the siting of call centers and other high-tech industries. And we were told, and I think most of us acted in good faith, that some of these might end up in rural communities. And if that were possible, it would only be because there were sites available or that could be made ready and available for the siting of these call centers, which would create great, stable jobs in local communities. But faced with the fact that there are very few shovel-ready industrial sites in rural Oregon, it would be doubtful that a community could get through the land use process in order to rent one of these sites in the time frame that would make it feasible for one of these call centers to locate. And that story is repeated time and time and time again. Let me also point out that the jobs that would be created under an exception like this would have to pay at 400% of the median wage. If you check the bill, that's a very high bar for an exception to be granted. And you'd have to create at least 10 jobs of this very high quality. So this isn't a bill that will be used very much, I think. When it is used, it would create wonderful opportunities for local communities. And, I'll answer whatever questions I can, but I wanted to leave the committee with words that I thought were inspiring words, and I won't attribute these words to a speaker. But the speaker said, it's people who defend the status quo that are going to have to make their case because the status quo is failing. The status quo is failing, and it is failing in rural communities to make sustainable economics possible. Part of the failure is in our zeal to protect very high value farmland and to stop the encroachment onto resource land, we've neglected the fact that the folks in many of the rural communities where the population density is very low defaulted to a resource value in their zoning maps. So anything outside the urban growth boundary was automatically considered high value farmland. If you do a soil map in those communities, you'll find that's just not the case. But the local community can't muster the resources to fight the battle on an individual basis through LCDC, through LUBA appeals, and against the combined weight of Farm Bureau and Thousand Friends. And so, you know, I highly respect Thousand Friends. I highly respect the Farm Bureau. They're on the ramparts defending a principle. And I'm down at the ground level arguing for something that would be practical. And the practical reality is that our communities in the rural areas are starving to death. Only Salem can throw us a life preserver. The life preserver is flexibility and land use planning. The sideboards on this bill are so high that only a very few communities that have a prospect in mind and the documentation for their need would have the ability to get over those sideboards. And I just want to point out, lastly, that notwithstanding everything else in the bill, the final bar to get over is that the decision of the local jurisdiction would be subject to a final determination by the Land Use Board of Appeals that the local jurisdiction had made a credible case for all of the issues that it's using to justify the decision. And if those, if the decision is not grounded and verifiably meeting all of the criteria set forth in the bill, the decision could be remanded or overturned. So it isn't without appeal. It's not blanket. You know, it isn't intended to overturn land use planning in Oregon as we know it. It will not lead to the wholesale conversion of high-value farmland, or likely the decisions will be made adjacent to already developed communities and only in consideration of 10 or more highly needed, high-paying family wage jobs. That's the story. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'll try to answer any of your questions, but I did not bring the phalanx of experts that I probably should have to answer your technical questions, and I'm referring to Senator Olson's grilling of the previous witnesses. Yikes.
Every previous witness.
Every previous witness. Nice.
Thank you for explaining what the bill does. Questions from committee members?
I do have a question. Senator, thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm trying to get my head around the sort of scenario for what you're envisioning, the company that would like to locate in the rural area and to help to invigorate the economy, which, you know, I think we all would like to see happen. Are there specific examples that you're thinking about where we've had problems with a particular industry? I mean, you mentioned call centers, but those employees don't get paid very much. What sort of obstacles have you run into that you can use as an example?
In a practical sense, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dembro, when I look at the communities that have infilled their boundaries, they're throughout the eastern side of the state of Oregon. Some of those infilled sites now house brownfields, places where we had sawmills and sort yards and, you know, other kinds of developed land. To repurpose those, you'd have to go through the whole land use process. And so, you know, just acts as an obstacle to redevelopment. In some cases, we've got urban growth boundaries that are relatively small because the communities are relatively small. And the manufacturing, the light manufacturing campus that people would like to see that would produce the kind of job you're talking about would require an urban growth boundary expansion. And that is, you know, something that I don't remember seeing an urban growth boundary accomplished in years. I don't even remember one in the last 18 years on the east side of the state of Oregon. And it's not because people don't need the additional land. It's because the process is so daunting that they end up feeling defeated before they start. But to your specific question, Senator, the best thing I can do is contact a League of Oregon Cities and the Associated Oregon Counties and ask them what kind of sites would this 748 apply to, and can we give a list of some of the swing and a miss type scenarios where folks wanted to get into an area and they just couldn't find a shovel-ready site. It wasn't many years ago, and Senator, I think you were in the building, when we tried to do an inventory of shovel-ready sites throughout all of Oregon. And we came up with just a handful, and none of them were actually shovel-ready. They were all weeks, months, or even years away from being available, suitable and available to start process to get them up and running as an opportunity, a job-creating opportunity. So I can show you where the obstacles are. I can probably make the argument against this as well as the people that will testify against the bill that will follow me. But I will tell you something. This is the status quo, and it's just killing us. So, you know, I guess what is requested is a life ring. You have the ability to toss it. Obviously, this bill will require a lot of cooperation between local jurisdictions and the state and all the land use professionals. We intended for that discussion and those cooperations to occur. But in the meantime, we just need a way to provide some high-quality, high-paying jobs in the areas that currently just can't accommodate them because of our well-intentioned and well-designed but perhaps overzealous, because one size doesn't fit all, land use regs. Other states have seen the same problem and solved it by allowing local jurisdictions to have some local authority subject to state review. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we are going to have up Roger Kay, Jason Miner, and Peggy Lynch. Then after that will be Dave Honeycutt and Marianne Nash.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding Senate Bill 748. For the record, I'm Jason Miner. I'm the executive director of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We strongly oppose Senate Bill 748 for the following four reasons, and I'll try and go through them quickly. I think there are several people here interested in testifying. First, there's no connection between the land use system and the criteria that are listed in the bill regarding automatic exemption or availability for an exception. The best case for this, in making the case for that statement, comes from across the river in Washington, where the Growth Management Act has 10 counties in eastern Washington that have opted out of the GMA and 21 counties that have opted into it. And the criteria cited in the bill of income levels in the 21 counties in eastern Washington, or the 21 counties in Washington that have opted into the GMA, the income level is actually 3% higher than in those 10 counties that have opted out. To my knowledge, that's perhaps one of the best examples that we can see of the effect of land use planning and growth management planning on economic indicators suggested in this bill. Second, as referenced earlier, there's already a system that provides for taking exceptions to the land use system. I won't go into that any further, but a use such as the one imagined could pursue an exception within the existing land use system. Third, I think the bill creates a profound uncertainty in anyone's property rights, in particular in those farm and forest land property rights that were referenced earlier. Imagine this scenario in which we create the ability for a local government to automatically take an exception for a potential commercial or industrial user. All across, by my count, 23 of Oregon's 36 counties would fit these criteria. So it's a broad swath of the state. Imagine anybody looking to a farmer and looking to invest in expanding their operation or looking to invest in their current operation. They will suddenly be competing with any speculator who might buy a piece of property on the hopes that the county is able to take an automatic exception to any of the state's land use goals and pursue it as a industrial or employment use. And fourth, I'd say our state's multi-billion dollar investment over 40 years in tax policy and protecting farmland actually insulated rural Northeast Oregon against the depths of the most recent recession. The Office of Economic Analysis summed up that in Northeast Oregon, the effects of the hit that Northeast Oregon took during the Great Recession was actually about half of the hit that the urban areas of the state took. And that's largely because the four biggest drivers of the economy, animal production, ag and forestry support, food manufacturing and crop production, are agriculture related. So there is an insulative value of our investment in ag and forest land protection in rural economies. I would suggest that while there are criteria in the bill, there's no provision as to whether or not the jobs, the 10 jobs that are referenced, are in fact permanent. The term full-time is used, but whether they're permanent, we do not know. Whether the jobs are local, in fact, is not referenced. It could be 10 jobs in New York City or Seattle or elsewhere. Those areas of lack of clarity, I think, make it profoundly difficult to evaluate whether it's worth undermining, again, the state's 40-year investment in the ag and forest economy. It's the second biggest part of our economy that we've currently made. The land use planning program creates jobs, doesn't create all kinds of jobs, but it creates jobs that have served the state well. And lastly, I would say, I and Thousand Friends of Oregon in no way stands for the status quo. We're supporters of the Brownfields tax credit bill, the Brownfields tax abatement bill, a land banking bill to help address Brownfields issues and site urban growth boundaries in the opposite chamber right now. Strong supporters have been working on that for a long time in an effort to make sure that those lands are available for development. And finally, we've taken very different approaches than our history might suggest in Estacada, in Kaiser, and in the Central Oregon Economic Opportunity Analysis. In all of those cases, we made extreme efforts to make sure that we were accommodating local jurisdictions in their conversations about employment land. I will cite that in Estacada, we saw the conversion in my decision not to challenge an urban growth boundary expansion in Estacada. There was a large parcel brought in ostensibly for industrial large lot development. That site was quickly converted to much smaller non-employment uses. It's one anecdote. Anecdotes shouldn't drive policy, but we've been flexible in many scenarios, and the results are mixed across the board. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Roger Kay. I'm current president of Friends of Marion County. Our organization and its individual members are opposed to SB 748 and request a no vote. We are a farmland protection organization founded in 1998. Our mission is to protect farm, forest, land, parks, and open space. I will try to list several reasons we oppose this bill, and here are just a few. Recently, Senate Bill 611, recently signed by Governor Brown, grants a series of tax incentives to companies expanding in Oregon. That bill received wide support among the cities and counties in rural Oregon. That bill allowed the city of Prineville to attract a data center within its UGB. That bill promoted business opportunities without sacrificing farmland. SB 748 would provide an exception to land use goals that would break our land use goals established to protect farmland and the UGB surrounding our rural cities. This bill will take land out of the base of Oregon's number two industry, agriculture. Third, SB 748 does not provide any mechanism for validation and accountability that permanent jobs would be created and verified. SB 748 takes irreplaceable farmland out of production and unfairly undermines investment in other lands. With the ongoing drought conditions, we need to preserve every acre of farmland possible. SB 748 is ill-conceived and a real threat to Oregon's landscape. We therefore request a no vote on this measure. Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a 95-year-old nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed citizen participation in government. No, I'm not 95. So rather than to take the tack that you have heard from the other two testifiers, I'd like to just talk about, I admire Senator Ferrioli's advocacy for his district and for the area. And I get it that there are issues with the economy in rural Oregon, in particular parts of eastern Oregon, amongst the John Day area and areas where he is addressing the issue. But it is a fact, sad though it may be, that people are moving from rural areas of the country, the United States, and into urban areas. And it just is true. And trying to move them back by allowing more land to sit idle because, in fact, unless there are real businesses ready to move there, is not going to be an answer that's really a true answer. I lived in Washington County in the 1990s when Intel was considering expanding. The reasons they gave for expanding is because Tektronix was downsizing and they had a great workforce to be able to call on. Washington County had just expanded some of its water systems, so they had abundant clean water. They wanted certainty, in Hillsboro, they had a particular area of industrial lands that had infrastructure ready, and they had inexpensive housing compared to San Jose nearby, and they had high-value K-12 public schools. It meant their employees got a bonus because they did not have to send their kids to private schools. Those are just some of the factors that brought Intel to Washington County. In rural Oregon, and particularly in the areas in Grant County and whatever, many of those factors don't exist. Sadly, what's happening with K-12 schools in much of rural Oregon is that they are moving to a four-day work week or four-day week. When you're trying to attract high-value employers, that's going to be a difficult sell. Bring your kids here to these schools. Now, those schools, some of them are great because they are small schools, which means those kids get one-on-one attention. But they don't have all of the amenities that they do in a large school system. I also want to mention a couple of other things. In Malheur County recently, the cities of Ontario, Vail, and Nyssa all were allowed to add industrial lands. We will see how long those lands either sit idle or how long before somebody asks to convert them to some other use, because that was done. So it's not as if it can't be done. The League is one of many working on House Bill 2254, which is a bill that was passed in 2013 to work on the UGB process. And there will be a separate process for small cities versus large cities. So we are working on amending, fixing, doing a better job of process in the future. And I guess one last comment, since I saw the time clock there. In these small towns, many of them, we are working on separate issues related to the fact that they do not have adequate sewer and water. And they don't have it today. And to assume that we're going to be able to find businesses who are willing to come in and pay the cost is just an unlikely scenario. So with all of those things, we ask that you not support Senate Bill 748. And be happy to answer any questions. I care about rural Oregon. I'm a native Oregonian, and lots of my friends and relatives live there. So.
Thank you, Reach. Questions for the panelists? Okay, thank you. Dave Honeycutt, Marianne Nash, and I'm going to ask people to start being brave. And I know that those before you had more time, but we are going to run out of time, so. Thanks. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash. I'm the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau, here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 748. As Senator Farioli explained, Senate Bill 748 would allow certain rural counties to authorize an exception from the statewide planning goals for employment uses that provide 10 or more high-paying new full-time jobs. While Oregon Farm Bureau certainly supports the intent and the overall goal of revitalizing rural communities, we do not believe that this bill is crafted carefully enough to accomplish that objective without significant detrimental effects on existing agricultural uses in those rural areas. I would dare say most of these rural communities that we're talking about, agricultural operations and their associated community benefits, are the top grossing exports from those counties, and it's important that those uses are protected. As drafted, Senate Bill 748 imposes no conditions on these types of uses, allowing the local governing body to approve them with no provisions for impacts on neighboring agricultural operations and no consideration for the agricultural operations in the community. And this is also raises a similar concern, and I won't bore you with it because I think you heard a lot about it in the Senate Bill 725 hearing. But this bill would also thwart Oregon's efforts to prevent a sage-grouse listing. As I'm sure you all are aware, DLCD is currently in the midst of rulemaking with sage-grouse as a Goal 5 resource to protect core habitat areas and provide mitigation if there's development that occurs in those areas. In rural communities that authorize projects under Senate Bill 748, they would have an exception from that Goal 5 planning process, and there would be no ability to protect those sage-grouse habitats. This process is designed to prevent a fish and wildlife listing that we are concerned is quite imminent. And it's part of our efforts to show in Oregon that, hey, we're doing enough to protect the bird here. There isn't a need for a federal listing. As I'm sure you all can imagine, a listing would be detrimental to Eastern Oregon ranchers and is something that everybody in the state is working really hard to avoid, and this bill could negatively impact that process. In talking to several of our members, their perception is that for large projects proposed in rural areas, it's not the state land use process that impacts the abilities of these projects to proceed. Instead, it's often the additional hoops associated with getting the state regulatory approval for other aspects of the project. And a lot of the projects are killed by the failure to obtain the necessary permits, even if they have the land use approval. As I'm sure you all are aware this session, farmers are facing many threats to their operations, increased regulatory burdens, increased acquisition of farmland for other uses, increased conflicts with recreational uses in rural areas. The list is never ending, and is one of the reasons that we will testify in support of one of the next bills you're here, Senate Bill 204. We think that this issue warrants further consideration. And we really need to be looking at how to best protect the agricultural heritage of our state and the agricultural heart of our state. It's one of our top exports and something that we should be working to protect. Conflicts in farmland is a real concern and one of the primary reasons that our zoning code exists in the first instance. So while we certainly support efforts to revitalize rural Oregon, they must be done in a manner that ensures that the primary driver of these rural economies is supported and protected throughout the process. So with that, I will conclude and take any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here in support of this piece of legislation. I would remind the committee that when you heard Senate Bill 25, one of the issues that we were talking about was the eight counties, and there are eight counties in this state that have lost population between the last two federal censuses. These counties are all in eastern Oregon, and it's obvious while agriculture is certainly important, and I don't disagree, it probably is the number one export in those eight counties. They're rural counties. The fact remains that it can't carry the burden. Agriculture can't carry the burden all by itself. It's not working there. They're losing population. Wheeler County has gone from 3,500 people in the 1950s to 1,400 people in the last census. That county is half of what it was 50 years ago. These struggling counties are examples of why legislation like this or Senate Bill 25 is necessary. We need to be able to provide for some type of alternative activity to go on in those counties. And when you zone everything, as the state land use planning system has done, zoned all rural land as farm or forest land, or actually 97% of it, with the significant state regulatory burden on those properties, you make it difficult for those counties to do anything other than continue what they're doing, which obviously isn't working. The assumption from the current system is that if we don't have state oversight, the county local elected officials will screw everything up, and I think that's an irritating assumption.
and one that I think the committee, when we did Senate Bill 25, got a good flavor for when we had all eight counties that would be affected by Senate Bill 25 send in letters in support of the legislation. They want some help. They want to do it by themselves. They don't want they're not asking for a handout. They're just asking to for a little bit of freedom and flexibility to make their own choices, and I think that's entirely appropriate. Now, whether I do it through this bill or picking up a pilot county and do a pilot project modeled exactly, not kind of or sort of, exactly after Washington's Growth Management Act, I choose the latter, but nevertheless, this bill is one effort to try and recognize that, and any of you, and I would invite all of you to take a trip over into Harney and Malheur and Wheeler counties and some of those areas and look around and look, go through town and look at the storefronts in town and tell me that everything is working just fine. So this is a good bill. I would choose Senate Bill 25, but I like this one too.
Thank you both. Questions? Members of the committee? Okay. Thank you both for being here and testifying on this bill. I don't have anybody else signed up for this bill. Before I close the public hearing, I just wanted to say that we heard this bill again because as much as I appreciate, and I know that some of you are probably by now thinking that I don't appreciate Oregon's land use planning system because of the bills I've been hearing, that's not true. I really appreciate a lot of what Oregon's land use planning system has done for us. I do think that there are a few blind spots in the system, and I think one of those blind spots is the ability of small, itty-bitty rural communities to comply. And so I know there have been efforts in Ways and Means through grants and planning grants and stuff like that, and I appreciate that. But, I think that more could be done. So I am far from believing that Oregon's land use planning system caused the problems in rural Oregon. I don't believe that. I just I see these same struggles in rural economies around the world. It's a national and international trend. I just don't think that Oregon's land use planning system should be a major impediment when there are some opportunities that could be at the doorstep. And if those opportunities aren't really at the doorstep of those local communities, then there's probably nothing to be afraid of because nothing would happen. So I know that this is a sensitive topic for a lot of people. I want to continue pushing on these conversations. This bill is not technically correct enough. There are some issues in order to move it now, but I do sincerely want to engage all the stakeholders in these conversations in the future, moving out of this legislative session and into the next legislative session, if not sooner. So having said that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 748, and we're going to do a couple of work sessions while I have all our members here, and we will start with opening up a work session on Senate Bill 266.
Beth. Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 266, there's a no revenue impact on the Dash 7 and a fiscal statement issued on the Dash 7 requesting a referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. The Dash 7 amendment that's on OLIS replaces the measure. It defines police-based integrated resources for the purposes of this act. It authorizes Water Resources Department to issue grants to a person, public body, or Indian tribe to facilitate the preparation of police-based integrated water resource strategies consistent with state laws, water resource policy, and department requirement. This act would sunset on July 1st, 2019.
Okay.
The Water Resources Department.
Water Resources, Raquel, you want to come forward, explain the amendments a little bit more, and answer any questions of the committee?
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, the changes that you'll see in the Dash 7s there's not actually that many changes from the dash twos, which is what you had previously seen. We worked with Water for Life in an attempt to address some of their concerns. And so the primary change that you'll see in the bill is first in section 2 sub 1, there's a definition of place-based integrated water resources. And basically, it's just defining it as a geographic area of a drainage basin. And that's been our intent all along, is to have these occur at a watershed or drainage basin scale. The other change from the last time is the sunset date. We actually moved it up to July 1st, 2019. So we're committed to continuing to make sure that this program would work for Oregonians. As we've said in the past, this is a voluntary program. It's not going to change existing laws, and it's not intended to infringe upon existing water rights, senior water rights, or basin plans. So if you have questions, I'm certainly happy to answer any of those.
Yeah. So we're, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. So we're talking about moving the dash seven?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
Wow. It's nice when it all comes together.
Gilpin.
Yeah.
Senator Olson, don't you have any questions?
Well, I know what's happened, so I don't need to ask any questions.
All right. All right. Giddy up. You got a motion?
Oh. Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 266, dated 4-9-2015.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 266, dated 4-9-2015. Is there any discussion?
Senator Thompson. Just a question. Will it go to the floor? Will it go to Ways and Means?
Ways and Means.
Okay. That's what designed. Okay. Thanks.
It's going to Ways and Means. That's what I'm going to move it to.
It is, yeah. Yeah, this is that we're adopting the amendments here, and then then on the next motion.
Okay,
Ways and Means. Okay, seeing no further discussion, are there any objections to adoption of the dash sevens? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 266 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 266 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And they can assign a carrier. Yeah, they'll assign a carrier there. So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 266, and we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 752.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 752 exempts carbon dioxide emissions from the combustion or decombustion of biomass from regulation under certain air pollution laws unless necessary to implement the Federal Clean Air Act. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a no revenue and no fiscal statement issued on the measure itself.
Okay. We didn't have a whole, we had a little bit of discussion, but this bill did not need any amendments per stakeholder input or department input. So I think we're ready to go.
Chair Edwards. Thumbs up. Chair Edwards, I move that Senate Bill 752 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves that Senate Bill 752 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. And the carrier on this one will be Senator Canope. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 752. And next, that one's carried over. So we're back to our public hearing. So we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 204. And if whoever wants to kick this off, Richard Whitman, you want to come forward? And if there's anybody else you want to bring with you, that would be great. And Beth, you want to tell us briefly what the bill does?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 204, there's a no revenue impact and a no fiscal, or excuse me, and a fiscal statement issued on the Dash 1 amendment that is available on OLIS, requesting that the bill have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. The bill itself establishes the Working Force Advisory and Farm Advisory Committee. The Dash 1 amendment replaces that measure and establishes the task force on working farms and forests and requires the task force to accomplish certain things, declaring an emergency effective upon passage.
All right. You're up.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Brown's Natural Resources Advisor. As you've just heard on the bills you've heard this afternoon, our agricultural industry in the state is under pressure from a variety of different directions in terms of land conversion, in terms of additional regulation, in terms of other uses that are allowed on forest and farmlands. Senate Bill 204 would do two things. To assure that the future of our agricultural industry is sustainable in this state. First of all, there have been a series of sort of one-off issues that have come before this committee and other committees in the legislature regarding other uses of land on farmlands, whether it's wetlands or bicycle trails or event centers or whatever. You've seen a stream of legislative proposals around those issues. So the first piece of Senate Bill 204 is really to take a holistic view at agriculture in our state and the use of agricultural lands and all the various uses that have been or might be allowed on agricultural lands in the future, and create a place where all the interests can work together to look at these issues as a whole rather than on a one-by-one basis. Representative Clem on the House side made a real effort several sessions ago on this, but it's really time for a holistic look at these issues. So the first part of the bill, again, is the establishment of the task force on working farms and forests. It would look at land conversion issues, conflict issues, and what tools the state has to assure that our agricultural lands stay in active agricultural use. The task force would report back to the legislature at the end of 2016 with recommendations for legislation in the next long session. So that's the first part of this bill, is the task force element. The second part of the bill is the Clean Water Fund. And when you think about the one of the pressures on our agricultural lands is concerns about regulation having to do with water quality. At the same time, our agricultural lands are where we still have some of the most difficult issues with regard to water quality in the state. So how do we address those issues while also assuring we are not undermining the economic vitality of our agricultural uses? We have tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds, that are being spent in this state every year around agricultural water quality. Much of that funding comes from the federal government through the Natural Resource Conservation Service, the Farm Services Agency, but the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board is also a major funding, and there are other sources that I'm not going to go into in the interest of time. The purpose of the Clean Water Fund, the second part of this bill, is to provide a dedicated, targeted funding source for the state to work with agricultural landowners in certain parts of the state that are where we have the biggest opportunity to get bang for the buck in terms of additional investment in water quality. By bringing some additional state funding to this effort through a lottery-backed bond funding that's in the capital construction bill, the idea is to target those federal programs to places where we're going to get the maximum impact in terms of water quality investment. There are a lot of details to be worked out on this concept, the Clean Water Fund. We have been working very hard with the Farm Bureau and also the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We intend to keep working with them. In the way this bill is set up, there would be a need for rulemaking in order to work out the details, and it's intended that that be done in a collaborative fashion with the industry interest as well as conservation interest. So with that, I'll conclude. I've got Maida Lofsgaarden here from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, as well as Katie Koba from the Department of Ag to provide a little bit of their perspective on this bill. But on behalf of Governor Brown, we'd ask for your support.
Do the dash ones, is that what we're talking about, dash yes. ones, and they replace the bill?
Yes. Chair Edwards, I'm speaking to the dash ones. Okay. That's correct.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Just a point of reference. Richard, you said that the commission or task force group would have to report back to the legislature by the end of 2016. Can you tell us the date? I'm just concerned as to if it's like December, that may be too late as compared to reporting in September at the interim committee meetings, and that way stuff needs to be drafted. It can be put in the hopper.
Chair Edwards, Senator Brzezinski, it does say December 31, 2016. I understand your concern about timeliness in terms of having a proposed legislation introduced in time. You know, what we've done in the past, it is assure through the work of the task force that, in fact, they are done to a point where they're ready to put legislative proposals in advance. So if it's a governor's recommended bill, which it may or may not be, as you know, those bills normally go in more like September, October. If it is going to be a bill that we're going to ask a committee or legislator to introduce, then we have a little bit more time. But so I would treat the December 31 as a no later than for that reason.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. Just very briefly, I want to talk about the importance of both of these concepts to work that we're engaged in with the Department of Agriculture in cooperation with the industry. First of all, the task force and the focus on what we talk about in terms of cumulative effects of very many good ideas that all are interested in using farmland in this state. And that we know that perhaps some of these in and of themselves do not have a significant impact on farmland, but what we're seeing is, again, that accumulation of multiple activities that are interested in being located on farmland and the concern to maintain an adequate land base so that farmers can keep farming in the state. So we're very much supporting the task force effort to look at all of those interests in terms of locating facilities or other activities on farmland. The second piece, the Clean Water Fund, would be a very, very important tool in our toolbox in terms of continuing the strategic focus on the department's agricultural water quality program. Some of you have served on the interim Senate Environment Committee where we've made multiple reports about how we're advancing and taking our ag water quality program really to the next level. And this we view as a very, very important component of that. One of the things that we've learned, particularly in this state, when you look at the CREP program, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, that is administered by the federal government, and the state plays a role in partnership with that. In some parts of the state, the lease payments that are paid on the CREP program are enough to incentivize landowners to participate, but in other parts of the state, they're not. And so one of the ways that this fund would be used is really to augment those lease payments so that we're able to target these resources in places in the state where we know we need some efforts around ag water quality. So very supportive of both of these components, and are working in partnership with all of our colleagues to move them forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Maida Lofsgaarden, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I want to speak briefly to both parts as well. The first part with the task force, over since I've been with the state, these issues have come up numerous times, ranging from the working land easements component to the issues related to conversion of farmland. I'm pleased to see them all in one place. I think a lot of these have complex interactions, and the opportunity to look at that comprehensively I think will be a benefit and helps us to more appropriately address these comprehensively, because we do have a lot of different programs that have impacts. So we're very supportive of that.
I want to speak a little bit more specifically to the Clean Water Fund, which would be coordinated through Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. As Director Koba mentioned, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program has been incredibly successful here in the state. 42,000 acres of riparian habitat has been protected through that program. Rental payments, 10 to 15-year rental payments. In Oregon, there has been $108 million paid out in that program since 1999. But it does not come without its challenges. It's a program that is largely designed for the Midwest. It's a bit of a assumption that there's a one-size-fits-all. And Oregon is anything but a one-size-fits-all state. And so, as Director Koba mentioned, the challenges with the rental rates that are paid in some areas of the state, something that we can't shift with the federal program. In addition, there's a maximum of a 15-year contract with that program. While that can be re-upped, if Congress doesn't continue the program, what you have is an opportunity. Landowners are very interested in extending those contracts, but that opportunity may not exist. From the congressional perspective. So this would take those contracts and make them 50, 30, or 50 years, which provides a lot more assurances from a non-regulatory perspective. Finally, there are other programs through U.S. Department of Agriculture that will pay for the improvements in riparian habitat or farm water quality, but don't have the associated contracts. And so that ability, again, in those cases, to pay that long-term rental rate would be a great advantage for Oregon and put us in a very unique situation to really comprehensively address agriculture water quality in basins across the state. Thank you for your time. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator. I had an intern look at this bill, and he came up with a couple of questions. In the original bill, I don't know whoever could answer this, had 11 members, 5 appointed from the governor's office, and this amendment changed it to 7. And 2 from the speaker's office and 2 from the Senate president's office. So who got excluded? Who else was going to get on there that got excluded?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, I worked on the Dash 1 amendments for this, but frankly, I can't remember excluding anybody in particular. I think the original bill may have been more general, but I'd be happy to go look at that and get back to you offline. The overall intent in saying who's on the task force was to make sure we had 4 members from the legislature, so bipartisan, bicameral, make sure that we have a good legislative involvement in this task force, because it's a complicated issue and we're going to need folks who are engaged and able to work this when we come back. And then otherwise, we wanted to make sure we covered all the main landowner groups and I think conservation interests as well. So that was basically it.
Follow-up. So when this, after 2016, when the task force gets done with this, is this going to be, who's going to, is it going to be Department of Ag that oversees this, DEQ? Is it going to be Water Enhancement Board? Who do you see overseeing this Clean Water Fund?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has the lead responsibility in terms of the Clean Water Fund. But as Director Koba indicated, the intent is for it to work really hand in glove with the strategic investment areas program that the Department of Ag has been developing over the last couple of years to target the work that they're doing under the Ag Water Quality Program. So it's really both agencies working together.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Senator Olson. To answer Senator Thompson, you eliminated the state forester, the director of agriculture, director of LCDC that could appoint one, state fish and wildlife. These are all important people as compared to legislatures going on the board.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, they are important people, but they're also, folks in the executive branch that I think are intended to help staff the committee, and there's language elsewhere in the bill about the requirement for both the Department of Forestry and other agencies to provide staff support to the committee. So, in taking those people off, there was no intent that those interests don't get reflected, but it was just felt more appropriate that they're really more in a staff role to the committee rather than a decision-making role.
Follow up. But then you put on four members of this body, House of Representatives, Senate, and they have no voting.
I was going to get out of here.
Rights. Now that leaves everything that the governor appoints to do the voting and legislative body. We can input information, but we can't.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. Again, the reason for that was. I think there's a legal concern about having legislative members be voting members of a task force where it may be taking on some of the recommendations it may be making are recommendations to executive branch agencies as well as the legislature. So I think that's the only reason for having that in there was for that concern.
Okay, follow up?
Yep.
Just a question on the riparian. It says you're going to manage the riparian areas for working farms. Who's going to be out there doing the work if the rocks fall away?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the assumption of this program is that it works in the way that Oregon has set up since the late 90s, and that is through Watershed Councils, Soil Water Conservation Districts, and other local organizations. So the goal of the program is not that either the Department of Agriculture or the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board are the local implementers for the program, but that it is really managed with those who work most closely with farmers and ranchers on the ground.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I might add, in our agricultural water quality program housed within the Department of Agriculture, there is funding that goes specifically to the state soil and water conservation districts to carry out the work of the ag water quality program. So that this is not work that we have enough staff in-house to do. That partnership with the state soil and water conservation districts is very, very important.
A follow-up. Yeah. So we hire somebody to go out there and fix whatever has been washed out by a flood or to put in what the riparian improvement is going to be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the soil and water conservation districts do that. Yes.
Thank you. And one last question. It says here that these incentives can be, these programs can be combined. How much can a farmer make off of all the programs we have available? Is there a limit? Is there a cap?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson.
I can answer that question. Not enough.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the goal of the program is not necessarily a stacking in the traditional sense, but more a filling in of the gaps to make the program make sense on the ground. So, for example, where the Environmental Quality Incentives Program may pay just for the planting that goes on the ground and some early weed management, this program would then take on the rental payments that would carry forward into the future that would be based on a local market rate. In the instance that Director Koba mentioned with the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, where the rental rates are well below market value, the goal of this program would be to put them to the level that is market value. So it's only in the interest of getting to a rate that makes sense from a market perspective for the landowner, not to stack beyond that.
Okay. And one last follow-up. This is for riparian areas. If a farmer doesn't have any water running through his property, can he avail this program?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, for this program specifically, it is tied to riparian areas. The Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has a $70 million biennium that is directed towards both in-stream riparian and upland projects, and so we would focus them outside of those riparian areas on our other grant investments.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you each for being here. Yep. We've got some more testimony. I think everybody's that wants to testify is in favor, so I'm going to suggest that you keep it brief because I think we have a committee that is locked and loaded and ready to vote it out, but we're going to lose members here.
I've got my 5 o'clock, so yeah. Are you wanting to vote that out today?
I'd like to vote this one out today.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask those who are here to give us yes testimony if they'd rather have the bill voted out or not?
Okay, so I'm going to call your names.
We do have additional amendments.
Okay.
I think the governor's office is aware of. But
okay. Well, then why don't you come forward? We won't vote it out today. So, Marianne Nash.
Oh. So now do we have to listen to the vote?
Yeah. Yep.
And so Floyd
can go to his committee, his so next close. Committee. Marianne Nash, and then Amanda Rich, and then we'll have Jerry Nicolescu and Sarah O'Brien. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash here at the Oregon Farm Bureau, and we'll start out really briefly. The portion of the bill that we have amendments on is the Clean Water Fund, and there's just some additional language that we've been working with the governor's office on, and they are aware of it, and we're hopeful it'll get in. So I will definitely defer to the best way to get those amendments in, but just know that there are additional comments coming.
Okay. So we do, Richard has. So we do have, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Right.
I would want to know if you're comfortable with that. I don't want you to feel like you're getting rolled and it's going to go to Ways and Means and then you're never going to be able to talk about it again. So I'm going to come forward, Richard.
I'm not leaning in.
I mean, as long as there's a commitment to get them done and get them addressed, I'm fine either way.
And Chair Edwards, that's why I came up for the record, Richard Whitman. We have been working with the Farm Bureau. We are committed to making amendments in Ways and Means to keep Farm Bureau supportive of this bill.
Okay. Is that a blank check offer?
Well, no. It's reflective of the good working relationship that we have.
Okay.
And that is on the record.
That is on the record.
It is.
Okay. Did you have, do you want to testify more specifically or?
Yeah, I'll testify more generally on the Working Farms piece and also then on the Clean Water Fund piece. Okay. So we are supportive of the Working Farms and Forest Task Force. As this committee has heard several times, there are a myriad of issues facing rural Oregon and agricultural areas in Oregon. Ranging from issues with succession planning, issues with securing financing for places, issues with conflicts related to land use, issues with creating the right incentives for young folks to want to get into farming and ranching properties, and also making sure that there's enough land available for them to make that investment make sense. Looking at issues of outside investments in agricultural land in Oregon and how that's impacting Oregon's agricultural base. So we have heard and been involved in these discussions for several years and are really happy that there's a task force coming together to look more comprehensively at these issues and ensure that our rural communities are being protected and that folks can keep farming and ranching. We do have a couple just nitpick edits on that section. We basically had a kind of short time frame to turn around our amendments, so there will be some small amendments to that section forthcoming. We are very supportive of the concept behind the Clean Water Fund, but do have some bigger picture concerns about the language, making sure that it's kind of evidencing the correct relationship to both conditions we want to see over time and to the existing regulatory structure under the Ag Water Quality Management Act. So we will get these amendments together and appreciate the commitment to get those handled either here or in Ways and Means, whatever works best for the committee.
Thank you. And I don't want you to feel rushed. I just thought we had the opportunity to move the bill today, and the calendar stacking up in subsequent days. That's why if I had the opportunity to move a bill, that's great, but I hear your concerns. And so, it sounds like Richard Whitman from the governor's office is committed on the record to working on this in Ways and Means, if you're comfortable with that.
Absolutely.
But I want to hear from everybody else, so everybody feels. Thank you.
Let me just stay up here. Or
yeah, you can stay up there if anybody else has any other questions.
So are we going to vote on this? No.
If I don't lose, I think I'm about to lose Thompson as well. So
maybe we don't agree on the yeses.
No.
If we're ready to vote.
Find out. These guys are commiserating, so
okay.
Check with them afterwards. Go ahead, Amanda.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amanda Rich, and I am with the Nature Conservancy. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 204. Very briefly, for many of the reasons that you've heard stated today, we're very pleased to see this task force. It's a long overdue collaborative and comprehensive discussion of the important issues that you see set before that task force. We do. We also have a little amendment that we'd like to talk to the governor's office about in terms of making sure that there is an accurate representation of the diversity of conservation interests that care about these issues that reflects the diversity of landowner, other type of landowner interest that you see reflected on the task force. But again, we're we'd like to see the bill move. So
at least a dash two and a dash three.
No, not going to stand in the way of the bill moving. Then also testifying in support of the Clean Water Fund as well. And I will not go into great detail over that, though I will say that in looking at the amendments, as I understand will be coming, it would be nice to explore whether or not we can look into paying out of that fund for the maintenance and monitoring of the long-term agreements that you see reflected in that program. I don't know if the funding source allows for that, but if it does, I think that safeguarding the state's investment through some monitoring and dollars would be helpful. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Nicolescu. I'm with the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I'm not going to add any dashes because this committee wants to dash out of here. But I am speaking on behalf of the 45 soil and water conservation districts in the state and the 90 watershed councils in the state. And I'm speaking on behalf of the local implementers, all 135 of those entities out there. And this is a unique partnership. And we have a proven track record of being able to work within this task force and do what needs to be done and bring that the information and the input needed to help that task force make its decisions. We also have the ability within the Clean Water Fund that is being proposed to use that fund in a number of different ways. And I could go on with innumerable acronyms and others of programs and entities that we've worked with and put these agreements and leverage the funds from. But in the interest of time, I will not do that except to tell you that both groups support this bill with the amendments wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Questions for the panel?
Not a question, just a comment. Remember that this body can sweep those funds and interest anytime we want. So be careful what you ask for.
Okay. You don't have to answer.
You don't have to answer, no. Just want to remind you that we can.
Okay, and last person signed up, Sarah O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sarah O'Brien with the Willamette Partnership. We're an incentive and conservation nonprofit that focuses on incentive and market-based conservation efforts. We're supportive of the bill. I have some friendly suggestions. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say amendments, but in view of the time, I'm happy to submit those in written testimony and also in writing to Mr. Whitman. So thanks for your consideration.
Yeah, question. What do you think of the bill overall, though? You've got some minor tweaks, but everything else is okay?
Yeah, we're very supportive of the bill. It strikes us as a unique opportunity to coordinate and leverage a bunch of investments that have been fairly scattered across the landscape so far, and really have a more effective approach to bringing together voluntary conservation efforts on working lands.
Thank you.
So we're going to work the bill. Senator Thompson was predisposed to support it, and I think that if it might make him crankier if I brought him back.
Yeah,
he might not support it, so I don't know. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 204. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 204.
Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 204 dated 4/3/2015.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 204 dated April 3rd, 2015. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll just say, I really support the work of the Clean Water Fund, and, I think that the issues that the task force are going to have to work on is going to be very difficult, but very, very important. All too often, I think, we talk about the conflict between rural and urban Oregon, but over this year, I've really come to appreciate the conflicts within rural Oregon. And, whether we're talking about coexistence issues or neighbor-to-neighbor conflicts, et cetera. And I think it's really important that we look at these in a broad way and see not only how we can come up with a methodology to address those conflicts, but how we can sort of build mutual support to you know, improve the rural areas. So, I don't envy the work of this this task force. I hope I don't get stuck on it, but but I admire them.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. We have a motion on the dash ones. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 204 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 204 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any further discussion? I guess my only comment would be heard some concerns, some minor concerns, still working on language. I heard expression of a good faith effort between Richard Whitman and the governor's office and some stakeholders that spoke here. I'm getting head nods, so we're moving it on under that understanding that can still happen in Ways and Means. So are there any objections?
No, but Mr. Chair, I would make the admonition that if it doesn't get fixed, we can always stop it on the floor.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Seeing no objections, so ordered, and note for the record that Senators Przanski and Thompson are both excused. Close the work session on Senate Bill 204 and open up our last public hearing of the day, which is a public hearing on Senate Bill 952. Richard, you want to come forward?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Brown's Natural Resources Advisor, here today to testify to Senate Bill 952. First of all, thanks. Appreciate the committee allowing late introduction of this bill and the committee's consideration of this bill today. This bill addresses another one of those issues that keeps popping up in different venues around the building and over the biennia. This particular session, we have over a $20 million funding gap for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We also have a significant funding gap for the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. There's significant tension between fee payers that are supporting many of the programs and natural resource agencies and the increasing cost over time in those agencies. There's also a continual back and forth with how much general fund support there is for this group of agencies that are part of state government. Another challenge for these agencies in terms of funding long term is that the people and the legislature have devoted portions of lottery funds to these agencies through a constitutional measure and then otherwise. Well, lottery funds, as many of you know, are flat at best, and so on the revenue side, the picture is not rosy for this group of agencies, and the agencies have been under significant cost pressure, particularly in the last in the Great Recession and recession before that. If you look at the actual number of FTE in these agencies, it has not kept up with population growth in the state of Oregon, nor has their funding. There aren't any magic bullets here. A lot of folks would like to think that there are magic bullets. Just go and ask you all for more general fund appropriation for these agencies, but you all are dealing with funding, education, public safety, healthcare, other priorities for the state of Oregon, and we recognize that. There have been discussions in this session about assuring that the full cost of some of the regulatory programs that we have are borne by fee payers, but on the economic development side, there's concern that if we were to do that, we would be disincenting important economic activity in the state. So again, there are no magic bullets, but just like with the last bill, we felt it was time to pull this discussion into a single place and have a holistic conversation and effort directed at the next legislative assembly on this issue on the farm issues, we felt we should do the same thing here on the funding issues as well. The time frame here is more expedited. This task force is to report back to the Legislative Assembly by early 2016, not the end of 2016. So the purpose there is for at least one of these agencies, we know there are going to be ongoing fiscal issues during this upcoming biennium. And so the intent is to have a report back sooner rather than later on these issues. The last thing I want to say about this is anticipating some questions that this all is about funding, 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 revenue, revenue, revenue. It's my expectation that this task force will be looking on the efficiency and cost side as well as on the revenue side. That needs to be part of the discussion here in terms of what is the sustainable future for these agencies, for these functions of state government. So with that, I'll close, and I would be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Richard. Questions?
I'll be very brief.
Yeah.
I appreciate this, to look at an overall concept where we can bring more revenue in, but I would remind you, in the retail industry, when sales fall off, you lower the prices and you get more people into the stores.
And Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, that discussion's going on right now in the context of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's
excellent.
Very much part of that issue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's move questions.
Okay. Move it.
Thank you.
Oh, not moving?
Thank you.
I thought it was moving.
Not yet. Next up on this one, we have Roger Beyer. And then, you can all sit up here at the same time. Roger Beyer, Amanda Rich, and Tom Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, here testifying in opposition to House Bill 952, Senate Bill 952. You should have submitted to OLIS a letter from a group of natural resource-based associations. I think the main issue here is a task force that states a predetermined outcome is what gives us the most concern. In the bill, you will see that it says I'm looking for, as I'm talking, trying to figure out exactly which, I think it's subsection 2, section D. No, that's not the right one. Anyway, the task force predetermines that the fees will support these agencies in total, and they should not be looking for general fund. I think that goes exactly opposite as what these groups think we were looking for. We do not think we need more user fees in these agencies, but more general funds, and that is the concern. The task force, as we see it, is asking for a predetermined outcome, and we cannot support that language. Happy to answer any question, Mr. Chair.
We'll go through all three, and then we'll come back to questions. Go ahead, Amanda.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amanda Rich, representing the Nature Conservancy. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 952, and I'll be very brief. But over the course of my career, as I've had the privilege of working with natural resource agencies, the same theme has come up: the struggle to pay for the work that these agencies do for the greater public good of all of Oregon, that just simply does not match up with a specified funding stream that many of them are constrained to. And so actually, to speak somewhat directly to what you just heard, the concerns from Mr. Beyer, I think actually what we're trying to look for is a stable way of funding these agencies so that it is not entirely on the backs of fee payers and individual directed funding streams. And so I think looking at a larger solution, brainstorming in a collaborative fashion around the work of these agencies and how to fund them is long overdue. And with that, I would take any questions. Thank you.
Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Tribal Limited. You already have my testimony on OLIS, so I'll be very brief. This bill does look at all funding options. It looks at general fund. It looks at other creative ways. It's about how do we fund these agencies. I have been working with natural resource agencies in the state for over 25 years. I have been actively involved in budgets for all of them. This is a crisis facing our agencies. If we do not look at long-range ways to fund these agencies, the good work that they do, for our country, for our state, for the natural resource users and the natural resource recreators and all the Oregonians who enjoy our resources, they're going to disappear. And that may be overly dramatic, but we have to solve this funding crisis. It's the number one issue facing natural resources in America right now is funding natural resource agencies. And with that, I'll end.
I have a question.
Yeah,
Mr. Wolf, I found the line that Mr. Beyer was talking about. The task force shall consider the option of requiring the regulatory fees cover all costs of state natural resources. What about the person that lives in the city and drives out into the country in the beautiful forests and enjoys the areas, but has no input into it other than through his general fund dollars, which would not go into the natural resources mix by this statement?
When one of the things we need to look at, and I think this, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, one of the things that this opens up in this bill is looking at ways to get funding from that group of people. I mean, I don't have an absolute answer for you right now, but let me tell you, that's been discussed a lot. There's got to be a way to get money from the people that just view wildlife. The people that view wildlife bring in $1.5 billion a year in the state of Oregon. They're the number one user of fish and wildlife resources. So there has to be a way to look at that. And I believe this bill opens the option of getting some very smart, intuitive people together in a task force to look at ways to address that so we can get money from that group of people.
Yeah. What do you say to the folks like myself, perhaps, that go into a state park and have to pay and get upset the fact that we've paid for this with our tax dollars and we're paying again for it? What do you say to those people?
I say that part needs to be addressed, too. I don't know if we can do that in this task force, but we need to look at ways that we can fund our agencies without overcharging Oregonians. And I'm certainly willing to look at that. I mean, I'm a guy that works for a nonprofit. I drive a 22-year-old truck, and I certainly know about having to pay too much for stuff. So certainly I think that this task force opens the option of looking at ways that we can fund these agencies without overcharging Oregonians.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thanks. So this is something we've been talking about a lot in the natural resources sub, particularly last week when we heard the ODF&W budget. And there is the challenge that, you know, the number of people who are using hunting or fishing licenses is not going up in line with the population, but the number of people who are going out and, you know, enjoying the natural resources, doing more, you know, non-conventional things like whale watching, et cetera, you know, we've heard about that. And so, you know, they should also, those of us who do that should also be participating in the support of those, whether through higher general fund dollars or some other way.
Birdseed,
right. So I think, you know, I think that the intent of this is right on target. You know, for me, so I have a hard time with LC language after 5 o'clock in general. This bill seems a little murky to me just in the way that it's worded. But I think we understand the intent, and as long as we're comfortable that this language reflects that intent, that is that the task force will look at, you know, ways of diversifying the funding stream to assure adequacy while, you know, sort of spreading the load, you know, I'm very much in support of it.
Thank you each. I don't have any additional questions. I'm not comfortable moving the bill today. What Roger said, I mean, and Senator Olson pointed out, there is that line, which is in section one, sub two, but then sub below that says that in, I think it was, I'm getting murky too here, and it was in B, no, in D. Yeah. So it, in D it says options for insurance, so should be considered D, options for ensuring that general fund support is not reduced as a result of new services provided by. So, I mean, I'd just like to spend a little bit more time with the authors or author of the concept and make sure that we're kind of all on the same page and before we work
the bill.
That
was us, wasn't it?
So,
yeah,
well, we introduced it. We sponsored it. Sponsoring is not the same as authoring. So, and I requested the bill draft, but that's it. So,
it's a great concept, Mr. Chair. It's very important, I think.
Okay, so we are going to we can close the public hearing and then carry over the work session, right? Okay. So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 952. Going to carry over the work session on Senate Bill 952. I don't know if that requires a gavel tap or not, but hey, why not? And then let me just pause just for a moment. So we carried over. Let's just stand in recess for one moment. We are back in order, calling back to order. We are just in recess. And before we adjourn for the day, I want to reiterate the bills that we are carrying over, because if anything gets missed from here on out, it's dead and it's chamber of origin. So I just want to make sure we didn't miss anything. So I wanted to reiterate for the record that Senate Bill 163 is being carried over, as stated earlier. Senate Bill 164 is being carried over, as stated earlier. Senate Bill 952 is being carried over, as stated earlier. Senate Bill 246 is being carried over, as stated earlier. Senate Bill 412 is being carried over, as stated earlier. And Senate Bill 829 is being carried over, as stated earlier. If it wasn't on that list, it was either worked or it's not being carried over. So with that, we are adjourned. So with that, we are adjourned.